amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show. I'm Steve W. It's been a short week for the UK in financial markets for one very obvious reason. There is, of course, a large event at the start of the week. I'm speaking, of course, of Paul's birthday, which was on Tuesday, the day after the bank holiday. I'm not exactly sure how old he is at the moment. I think he might be 34 or 35 or something like that. He continues to invest like a cross between an 18-year-old and a 72-year-old. Steve, how's your week been? Any idea how old Paul is?
No, but I think around that kind of age, and me being of that kind of age, it's the age where you have to figure out by using maths how old you are. By taking your date of birth, trying to remember what year it is, and then figuring out when your birthday, whether it's been or not. So yeah, he's probably of that age. Yeah, I think in terms of my week, it's been all right. I've been ill all week, Steve. I actually had Tuesday off work. I have got some kind of like bug or flu or something like that. And I've had a headache ever since, including today. And it's one of those kind of headaches where the painkillers just make it feel a little bit milder. So not feeling particularly great. Portfolio, though, Steve's done pretty well. We're just trying to work it out then. Google Finance is lying to me, saying I'm up about 6%. I think I'm about a tenth of that, Steve, maybe 0.5%, something like that. How about you?
I am also up just about 0.5% or so, 0.56, I think, with some fairly rapid maths that are not super accurate, but they're not going to be far from the mark. So about 0.56, mostly led by Google itself going higher after they've decided that they are, in fact, pretty good at this AI thing. We've had sort of differing ideas about this over the last few weeks, one being that it's not that hard for Google to catch up to ChatGPT, another that being it doesn't really matter anyway, and it would be nice if this didn't become a thing that they get involved in too much. But it's been a decent week for me. It's been busy at work. It always is this time of year, such is the nature of having students panicking about finals exams and increasingly finding ingenious ways to hide from them. But I was struck by one important bit of news this week. I was trying to think to myself, what should we get Paul for his birthday? And the obvious answer is, of course, nothing. But I did see a story that Goldman Sachs have launched a range of Goldman Sachs branded stuff that they've been attempting to sell to their employees. Have you seen this story, Steve? Probably not.
No,
this is buried in the dark corners of the internet. But you can now buy Goldman Sachs branded merch, like branded hats, fairly obviously. Branded golf balls, which were less obvious to me that you would want a Goldman Sachs branded golf ball. Is that a big thing? Branding golf balls? Anyway, branded duffel bags and branded Patagonia vests. I'm not sure what they are exactly, Patagonia vests besides vests, and I couldn't be bothered to look it up because I only found the story this morning. But it did make me wonder because I heard some reaction to it from Goldman employees that have been talking about it, saying, why the hell would I wander around being like a kind of billboard for the company that I work for? Steve, can you imagine someone turning up at a financial show and like wearing kind of company branded kit?
No, I don't know anybody who would be as stupid as doing something like that. I think that's pretty pathetic, Steve, especially when they buy it with their own money and not with any company proceeds.
Yeah, if you're listening to the show only, then never mind. I thought maybe we could get Paul some of that, to be honest. That's the main interesting story that I heard this week. Things have been sort of fairly quiet, a little bit up and down in the markets. As we were saying, Google goes up, Southern Copper comes down. And in some cases, it's quite hard to notice if you're massively in the red or massively in the green on either one. What's a bit more or staying the same colour? I only really notice when things cross over.
Yeah, it's been a bit like that, hasn't it? It's been one of those weeks where quite often I've had something down 6%, but just underneath it, I've got something up 6%. And you kind of look at it and you think, well, hang on a second, what's going on here? And to be fair, Steve, I've not really seen an awful lot of Southern Copper news to see it fall as far as it has, and Google's news is equally as unimportant. I saw the Google Fold phone, which looks fine. Do you know, I'd be tempted to buy a Google Fold phone, but I found out they're about 1,500 quid, so I'm not massively in a rush to buy one. I might buy one when they get a bit more sensible. But they've released a whole load of AI features, Steve. It was a load of things that we knew they were already working on. And it's kind of crazy to me that the market's forgotten that Google has been talking about AI and machine learning for 20 years. And all of a sudden, this new upstart's come along and said, look, we'll release this thing that's absolutely burning through billions of cash a week. And they've gone, Google are rubbish. They're one of the worst companies I've ever come across. Why aren't they doing AI? These guys are eating their lunch. And it's like, none of this is true. It's just ridiculous. And we've done this now with Meta. Meta was rubbish. And then we've gone to Google, and now Google's rubbish. And I suspect we're probably doing it with PayPal now, even though we both hate the company. But we are now saying PayPal's a dead duck. It's trading at about 12 times or 13 times free cash flow, which is pretty cheap for a payments firm with decent margins. I suspect that will be the next company we discover isn't quite as crap as we think it is.
Interesting. That's not my pick for that title, but my pick for that title is one of the companies we're talking about today. So I will get to that when we arrive there on that one. I know, but I'm not surprised, by the way, that you're not planning on buying a 1,500 quid or dollar or whichever you said Google folding phone. Do you know why you're not interested in buying a Google? I do.
Go on, tell me.
Here's the reason. I've been re-listening to Scott Galloway on The Four this week, and he talked about Apple, who obviously make fairly high-priced tech. And he points out that, well, look, the thing isn't the tech that you pay for. It's because it signals your attractiveness as a potential mate. You say, if you wander around with your iPhone or your Rolex is similar, obviously not an Apple product, but you get the idea. But what you are effectively signaling to potential mates is, mate with me and your kids are more likely to survive than if you mate with someone wearing a Swatch, is his line. Which is a good line. I like it. I think probably, Steve, you and I think about potential mates the other way. We think I would be actively turned off by the thought that someone's going to hammer 1,500 quid into a smartphone. I'd much rather mate with someone who's going to spend 90 on it.
Yeah, I think that's probably the case. And I think I'm long past the point of peacocking my phone around trying to attract mates.
Well, what do you peacock now out of interest? Your bathroom?
Yeah, Steve, I'm definitely not peacocking my bathroom, because one of the things that eludes me as a skill, as some form of tradesman, is mastic sealing. If you see the ceiling on my bath, you would think a child has done it, and it's not the prettiest thing in the world.
Fair enough. Okay, I mean, we're not currently peacocking our bathroom. We've just had the house redone before we moved into it, after we took ownership of it, and we basically thought we're going to do the bathroom cheap once and then try and extend and then do it again better. So bathroom not a flex for us either. But if you're interested in demonstrating, you're also... when you're at the age like we are, I'm going to say, where I absolutely resonate with the thing you said of, yeah, I have to try and count backwards to how old I am. In fairness to me, the reason for that is that I'm an August birthday, and so most of the people I know from being in my school year are a bit older than me, and I constantly spend my time wondering, am I a year younger than you, or are we the same age now? Because eventually I kind of always catch up, but there's quite a bit of the year where they're all... saying a number one higher than me, and that includes now, because we haven't reached August yet. So I keep forgetting whether I'm a year, whether my wife and I are the same age, or whether we're a year different now. We're a year different.
Yeah, it is definitely strange how birthdays become just so insignificant as you get older. And people are like, oh, you know, when you're a kid and you get like 100 birthday cards and you end up with like 100 quid's worth of cash, and now you're lucky if you get a fiver and a card from anyone. It's like, what happened?
Yeah, actually, where I was going with that point, I distracted myself from it, was that when you reach the age where you have to sit down and count how old you are, I mean, not when you're at the low end of how old you are, but when you're at the 30-something end of how old you are, you should frankly stop peacocking with any damn thing whatsoever. Bathrooms, yeah. Phones, whatever. So, no, I am also not tempted to start peacocking with a Google folding phone, difference to a flip phone. Might get a flip phone, but I am not peacocking with those things. Should we talk about some other old people, Steve?
Let's do it.
Okay, Paul, no, the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting happened last weekend, and I was looking at it because I was at a wedding, so there was nothing else to do. But I got three sort of main takeaways from it. I tend to be our kind of bigger Berkshire enthusiast. No one else thinks it's a sort of terrible business or anything like that. I think it's a fascinating thing to follow for a lot of people, but I own... By my standards, quite a bit of it. By anyone else's standards, nearly none of it. But I own some shares. I'm interested in following it. Think it's really good and enjoy the meeting. Steve, did you have a look at it before I pile into any of my takeaways, or did you sit this year out?
I have seen a synopsis of it, so I assume you're going to tell me the things I've read.
Well, I've tried to not go for those things because I figured if it was the things that you'd read, then there wouldn't be much point to this particular section. But you tell me if I'm wrong and that you did read these things. Here's takeaway number one, by which I mean I thought of it first, not its most important. Berkshire stock is going down when Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger either pass on or retire or officially step down, something like that. I've wondered whether this was the case for some time. Buffett points out that, look, all of his shares are going to be held in trust. There's not going to be kind of any immediate forced selling or anything like that, which will help fend off some activist pressure, which might come down on them. My idea that it's going down has nothing to do with that. My idea that it's going down is that when I listened to the questions in a broad sweep of them, there was a more than I think there ought to be at a shareholder meeting, which was quite literally, tell us a story, Warren. Tell us a story, Warren. Tell us a story that you haven't told us yet, Warren. Tell us a different story, Warren, which is nothing to do with Berkshire Hathaway at all. So I think there's a decent, that makes me think there's a decent chunk of shareholder there who is not interested in the company. There's a decent lump of them who are interested in Warren Buffett, and that's a perfectly sensible thing to be interested in. He's an interesting guy, very successful. But I do think that once that no longer becomes a feature of Berkshire anymore, rather it becomes a sort of historic feature of Berkshire, I think that stock is going to go down because some people are going to sell it because, tell us a story, Warren, isn't an acceptable question at the shareholder meeting anymore. Because no one's saying, tell us a story, Greg. Back to that in a minute.
It's definitely a problem that when you think about it, isn't it? There is a bit of a cult of celebrity around Berkshire. And I think when Munger and Buffett do, you know, cease to want to do these question and answer sessions, I don't think they're going to be as well attended as they used to be because Greg just doesn't have the storied history, does he? So he doesn't have the things to... he may do, I suppose. He's never really been given the limelight, but he I guess a period of quietly getting on with the job is maybe what Berkshire would need to just keep going. It probably does need a, you know, steady hand on the tiller kind of thing, because I think the issue with when you have storied CEOs leaving like that is that the next person come along doesn't really ever have a chance. A bit like thinking in football terms when Sir Alex Ferguson left Man United, whoever was going to take the job after had no chance unless he played that expansive sort of like wing-esque football, beautiful football, scoring goals in the 170th minute of the 90-minute game, you know, abusing referees and what have you. You know, nobody was going to have the chance to follow them and be successful. And I think that might be the case with Buffett. And I think it was potentially the case with Disney as well, that we'll talk about later, depending on what you actually think about Iger and what have you. But it's going to be a really interesting period for Berkshire. And I think it's half the reason, and I think it's a trading mindset that I've probably got to get over, but it's half the reason that I can't get over the hump with Berkshire myself. I think that once Buffett leaves, I wonder if all of the draw of Berkshire goes with it.
I think that's a really nice comparison that I hadn't thought of, the Man United thing. I mean, I as a shareholder, I guess I'm betting the other way. I'm betting that Berkshire has an enduring moat that Man United didn't have at the time. But yeah, they replaced Sir Alex Ferguson with David Moyes, who I also view as a charisma vacuum, as well as Greg Abel. Back to Greg Abel, like I said, in a couple of moments. But that suddenly a lot of Man United's advantage goes away. I mean, Ferguson's ability to manipulate referees, and I that makes it sound like a bad thing. I don't view it as a bad thing. I think there's a sense in which in sport, especially in Premier League football, you do whatever the damn hell you can get away with to get an advantage, and he did it really, really well. And it got an awful lot of stuff done for Man United and made them very successful as a result. There's definitely an advantage to having Buffett around. There's something that comes with that name that allows him to negotiate deals that aren't otherwise negotiable, that whoever takes over from him, Greg in this case, but anyone, frankly, who took over from him wouldn't have. So someone there is picking up quite a hard and slightly heavy handicapped job. Buffett and Munger say all the right things, in my view. Like, well, the businesses run themselves. We don't actually do all that much. And this, I don't think they're lying when they say that, by the way. I think they genuinely sort of do. Their main part of their job is staying out the way and stopping stupid things happen. And I'm sure that someone else could do a reasonably good job of stopping other people doing ridiculous things. But I do also kind of think that... clearly, there is a class of shareholder there who isn't listening, who just owns a stock because they want to hear another fun story from Buffett and so on. So, I think that despite my kind of feeling that the business itself is going to be fine going forward, I'm fairly optimistic for that. I do think the share price is going to go down at whatever point it becomes announced that Buffett officially has nothing to do with the company, whether that's because he's passed on or retired or whatever.
It's that thing, isn't it? What they do is not quantifiable. It doesn't show up on the balance sheet. It's not an asset. But well, it is an asset, but it's not an asset. It's intangible, I guess, isn't it? And I wouldn't, but it's not recorded. So it's one of those things. I think Buffett, with the regulators, he's got a high chance of getting deals through because he permanently talks up America. He, you know, his famous saying is to never bet against America. So I think he just has a good reputation in the way that Ferguson did with the referees. I guess he has a reputation with them where he tends to get things through that other people wouldn't be able to get through. Fergie time, that's what it used to
that's
be called.
That's the one. Yeah, I saw a picture, a kind of obviously edited picture of him holding up a fourth officials board with a sign on it saying "Until we score," basically for how much time there was to be added on. Just as a side point on this, Greg Warren covers this stock for Morningstar and covers it quite well, I think. But I was reading his
Greg Warren.
Yeah, Greg
He's
Warren.
He's literally set up for the job. Is his middle name Charlie?
Probably. But he covers the stock for Morningstar, and he used to attend the analyst panel when there was an analyst panel. I was reading his coverage and takeaways from the meeting, and my God, he is a massive crybaby about the fact that there isn't an analyst panel anymore. I mean, it's just a big... there's quite a lot of it of him saying, well, we didn't find out anything interesting because there weren't any analysts there. It was just people asking questions about their personal lives and what they should do. He was right. There was an element of truth to that, but I thought there was more to it than he was giving it credit for. Here is something connected to that. Point number two. Greg Abel's a rubbish communicator. He is a really, really rubbish communicator at explaining how businesses work. I've no doubt that he gets them really, really well and that he has great insights into them and he's all over the details. And everyone at Berkshire, as far as I can tell, thinks very, very highly of him. But my God, he is terrible at communicating these things to shareholders. So he was asked a question at the previous meeting, which basically amounts to this. Union Pacific, the railroad operator that operates on the same side of the country as Burlington Northern does, has much better margins. They do this thing called precision scheduled railroading. Everyone thinks that's the reason. We don't do this thing called precision scheduled railroading, and we have worse margins. Why do we not do precision scheduled railroading, and why do we have worse margins? Are they connected? And his answer at the time was, I'm really proud of Burlington Northern. I think it's a great franchise. I wouldn't swap it for Union Pacific. End of discussion. Which isn't an answer to that question. So it was the same question again, actually, this time out. With someone saying, but you didn't answer me. And he basically said the same damn thing again, which was, oh, they do precision scheduled railroading. We think about our customers and the service that we provide to them. And I found that a kind of frustrating answer. I did manage to work out what the answer was, but not by listening to him. I was listening to the Business Breakdowns thing on Union Pacific, and because that's the railroad operator on that side of the country, they invariably mentioned the only competitor in town, which is Burlington Northern. And the guy called Matt Rose, who used to run Burlington Northern before Casey Farmer took over, said the following, roughly, which is, look, by precision scheduled railroading, roughly what this means is that you don't show up when your customers want, you show up when you want, and you make less trips and drag more stuff. So if you're picking up grain from a grain plant, then what you would do is instead of turning up, I don't know, five times a week and carting away six cartloads, you turn up once a fortnight and take away 60. And you turn up when you say you're going to turn up. And that's more efficient, basically. Trouble is, customers don't like that. So you're going to annoy them. And Matt Rose, previous Burlington CEO's point is, the more you annoy your customers and the more you make them do things differently, the more you just attract regulation. So the BNSF approach is to stay well clear of any kind of regulation and take a slightly lower margin. And it's big margins in this, surprisingly so. But the fact that Greg Warren couldn't communicate that to, in a way that I could understand either last year or this year, or refused to communicate it in a way I could understand either last year or this year, say, look, it's not about margins, I'm worried about regulator threat. Or we think there's something to be had by staying on the right side of regulation here rather than the wrong side of it by constantly trying to bleed out customers in what is basically a regulated duopoly up that West Coast. That to me is not that hard to communicate. And people can either agree with it or disagree with it, and there's no doubt healthy debate. But that ought to be something that Greg's capable of communicating, and I don't think he is, and that does cause me to worry a little bit.
Yeah, I think that goes back to what we said earlier. I think that Greg is just not going to be, unless they find somebody who is an adept communicator to take that role, you know, head up the panel and answer questions in the way that Warren does. I just think this big shareholder meeting is probably going to be, you know, potentially an earnings call like everybody else. I just don't think we're going to get the sort of Berkshire meeting that we're going to get when these two decide not to do it anymore.
Yeah, Buffett has a well-earned right, I think, to answer whatever damn hell question he feels like, or to say whatever he wants in response to questions, because I've been frustrated at his answers before. I mean, during the pandemic, when I first owned Berkshire and people asked him, why haven't you done anything? Stock prices are through the floor. He said, we don't see anything that we think is that attractive. And I didn't think that was a very good answer. I mean, it's probably true, but I didn't think it was a particularly helpful answer. But Warren Buffett giving that kind of answer gets a lot more sympathy, and it's earned sympathy, right, due to reputation and track record, both of which are well-earned, that Greg Abel doesn't have and hasn't earned. And that sort of mildly concerns me a bit.
Yeah, I can see that. He's earned the right to be wrong. I guess we've said that a few times before, haven't we, as Buffett, whereas Greg's yet to prove himself, he's yet to earn that right. The problem is that when you have a figurehead like, or figureheads like Buffett and Munger, that the people who are behind pulling the strings and doing good things for the business tend to get overshadowed. So the fact that Greg's in his 60s, isn't he? Is he late 50s or 60s? And we've not really heard much about him until now, and he's about to take the reins of, you know, one of the best public-facing businesses going, and we don't know anything about him, is probably why we're having this sort of like shareholder unease about him. And it doesn't help when he is finally given the limelight if he gives crappy answers and not the it's not the Berkshire way, is it?
No. Okay, that was my second point. I am concerned about Greg Abel as a communicator. I'm not concerned about him as an operator, by the way. I have no doubt he's a very, very, very good person to run Berkshire. I am wary that he's... no one is ever going to be saying, Greg, tell me this thing, or Greg, tell me a story about a Jeep, or whatever, because I don't think it'll make any sense if he does. Lastly, I was surprised at the bank stuff, I don't know about surprised, actually. I know he's been selling banks, so presumably he was kind of gloomy on this, but it did emphasize to me, I guess, what a heavy price is maybe the wrong word, what a heavy emphasis Buffett puts on predictability. So he sees Apple as an extremely predictable business. There's other reasons why you wouldn't sell Apple if you were Berkshire at the moment, mostly to do with tax, because you'd get hammered on the profits if you did. But basically, he said, Buffett, look, it comes down to this. Banks are regulated, and they're regulated by people who are, he didn't use this term, but I will, half-wits. They're regulated by people who don't necessarily understand banking. They're regulated by people who might well have an interest in having banking regulations that are not ideal for the society that you're in. And if you find yourself in that situation with any kind of industry, that is a risk. There is a risk that people might be incompetent. There is a risk that people might be conflicted with their general interests and so on. He doesn't see that as being the case with Apple. I think there's a chance people do dumb stuff around Apple and try to regulate it in ways they didn't ought to, but I was interested in that observation because when I think about Berkshire's biggest businesses, I think Geico, which is an insurer, which is auto insurance, which is regulated. I think of utilities business, which is definitely regulated in interesting ways. I think of BNSF, which is also regulated by Surface Transportation Board. So the idea that regulation by itself is a reason to start running out of bank stocks, maybe you can get rid of those more easily than you can get rid of some of the others, was sort of curious to me. He clearly views regulation in the banking sector different to how he views regulation in, say, the railroad sector or something.
Yeah, and to be fair, this is not a new concern for Buffett and Munger. They've been talking a long time about the understanding banks' balance sheets and derivatives and hedges and not really fully understanding that the risk that you're taking on by buying these banks, because a face value analysis of a bank is not the same as, you know, actually understanding what is, you know, the risk in the balance sheet. And that's actually been proven out with the regionals as we've gone forward here. If somebody said to you just 5 years ago, we've had an influx of 80 billion of cash, so we've put it all in bonds, you'd have gone, okay, that sounds like a good idea. And obviously now that we're going into this interest rate environment, they've literally been ticking time bombs, just waiting to go off. So yeah, I don't think that's a massively new issue. But I mean, would you like to see Berkshire run a bank? I think I'd quite like to see how Berkshire would run a bank. They tend to take these kind of industries and strip them down, make them simple, and make them work. I think a bank is one of those kind of industries that Buffett and Co. could run pretty well.
Yeah, in principle, yes. In practice, no. I think they do a good job running a bank because I think they're quite good at resisting temptation to go reaching for stuff, and that's the main thing that gets banks into trouble. In practice, no, because I think if they ran a bank, the rules would be they couldn't do a bunch of other stuff that they currently do. So I wouldn't like them to say, right, we're taking over Bank of America, to hell with all the utility stuff, we will spin this out or whatever we'd be kind of required to do. And I think that's the reason they don't. Charlie Munger talked for ages about how they ran this bank and it was an amazing bank. And he sort of sounded like Donald Trump, to be honest, talking about running a bank. And it was the most beautiful thing you've ever seen, a bit like Trump's wall. But there may be some truth to that, there may not be. But I think they would do a good job running a bank. The reason being, it's kind of like an insurance company, right? With the only major difference, or one of the major differences being, if you pay someone an insurance premium, you can't just ask for it back when you feel like it, where you can if you stick your money in a bank. And that's kind of the nice thing about insurance for Berkshire. You have other risks, right? In that if there's a massive hurricane, your bank deposit is probably still safe, but you have to pay out a load if you're an insurer and you insure that kind of thing.
And that's what's made Geico so successful, is that they don't go chasing risk. So you just take that formula and stick it on top of a bank, and I think you've probably got a pretty good foundation for a bank then. I'm amazed that there isn't many of these in America. I think of any at the moment in America that I would class as not going chasing risk. I guess Bank of America, to a degree, is probably one that I would say is not a massive risk chaser, but I don't think there's any in there that I could quite comfortably say are doing it in the way that I would say a Berkshire would.
Yeah, I don't think any of them are running quite that way either. Bank of America is interesting in that you sort of have a Berkshire put on it a little bit. If you think that, following on from what we were saying last week, that if there's really a crisis, and there's a crisis in something as big as Bank of America for the moment, never mind stuff the size of First Republic, which I know is big, but it's not on B of A territory. If you think that in a crisis the bets would be off as to what the rules are, JP Morgan can do what they like if someone thinks it's in the national interest. Berkshire Hathaway you can own more Bank of America if we think that's going to sort the problem out for us. If we have to pay for it or you have to pay for it and you can acquire them in the process, have it, Buffett. I don't care. Is likely what they're going to say, I think. But Bank of America are, as I understand it, the most of the, whatever they're called, structurally important financial institutions that people worry about the most in terms of mismatched bonds to expiries to durations and so on. But yeah, that's slightly more complicated. I find it difficult to believe that they're doing anything particularly dumb there, mostly because regulation doesn't allow them to.
So, Steve, before we move on, have you ordered yourself a Warren and Charlie Squishmallow?
I saw a story about those yesterday. You sent me a picture of them. I have not ordered myself a Warren and Charlie Squishmallow. Do you know why, Steve?
Because they're impossible to buy, I would assume.
Well, they're about 800 quid. $800, I think, in a resale thing. I saw they were being sold on like eBay or something for something around that area. That's, I think... I'm trying to work out the order of priority in weird flexes between a Charlie Squishmallow and... I didn't rate the Charlie one, actually. I rated the Warren one a bit higher. But between a Warren Squishmallow and a Google folding phone thing.
That would be something to show the peacock to the women.
Yes, that very much... like everything I own, it seems to make the women go in the opposite direction. Anyway, that was Berkshire Hathaway. I enjoyed listening to that meeting. I always do. I learned some stuff along the way based on what was said. I've tried to kind of stick my takeaways here to stuff that was either more implied or stuff that I interpreted or things that I think probably weren't everybody's kind of obvious takeaways for people who are trying to write articles in a hurry Forbes or whatever. But those are my thoughts. If you saw it and you thought something different, or if you think there's a better thing to peacock about, by the way, than the Warren Charlie Squishmallow, don't know what that would be, do let us know in the comments. But Steve, you've been looking at some different stuff.
Yeah, I've been looking at a couple of earnings this week, but we'll start with Airbnb. They released earnings midweek, and they finished about 17% down on the week, Steve, so it was a pretty hefty fall. So they're trading at about a $66 billion valuation at the moment, which is about $12 billion less than Shopify that we covered last week. So let's see if we can find out what the issue was. That's what we normally do when something falls like this, so let's see what we can find out. So just to let you know, Q1 is seasonally weak for Airbnb. So revenue came in, it was a beat, $1.82 billion versus $1.79 billion, which was expected. EPS came in 18 cents versus 9 cents expected. So pretty handy beats on either side. Revenue was about a 20% climb up since last year. And EPS, this was actually the first time in Airbnb's history that they've made net income in Q1. About $117 million in net profit versus a loss of about $19 million in the same quarter last year. Gross booking value looked pretty good. 19% jump year on year, equating to about 121 million nights booked with Airbnb. Active listings, so the supply side increased too, 18% year on year, which, you know, that's an interesting stat because that means that the supply side of Airbnb has accelerated every quarter since Airbnb went public. Guidance was just under expectations, with Airbnb expecting 2.35 to 2.45 billion next quarter. Analysts wanted 2.42 billion, so the midpoint is, you know, a couple of hundred million away, essentially. Airbnb warned of tough comps as we leave the post-pandemic comparators when travel boomed. But still, that's 16% growth at the top end of that guidance, Steve. So if you're saying tough comps, that's still pretty good. Some interesting stats for you. Airbnb continues to attract 90% of its traffic direct and does not pay for it at all. I know Paul doesn't like when we say companies that have become aware, but that's a clear benefit. Latin America is growing very quickly for them. Nights booked has now doubled since its pre-pandemic rate. Urban nights are growing in popularity, reflecting 48% of bookings taken this quarter. And in terms of profitability, Steve, there was quite a lot to like here. Beat its EBITDA estimates by 1% and its guidance by the same amount. Comfortably beat GAAP EPS, as described earlier. Beat its free cash flow estimates by 55%. Although note that this is a good quarter for them in terms of free cash flow generation, as this is when people often book holidays to travel later in the year. This was actually represented in an 87% free cash flow margin, which you should extrapolate nothing from. $3.8 billion in trailing 12-month free cash flow, though, Steve, so that's not to be sniffed at. Airbnb has already used $2 billion of its buyback that it announced last time, but it is now topped up with another $2.5 billion to be bought back. Buybacks in this quarter doubled stock-based compensation, so we are actually seeing a notable reduction in count. Balance sheet is very healthy indeed, with over $10 billion in cash and only about $2 billion in long-term debt, which is actually cheap as well because it was taken out during the pandemic. On expansion, Airbnb has said results had exceeded their expectations. Testing a new marketing playbook, they said, has led to exceptional results. Bookings in Brazil have jumped 112% year on year, and in Germany have grown 70% year on year. So they're now going to test this playbook in the rest of Asia Pacific, as well as broadening the test in more European countries. So they've said to watch this space. In terms of booking backlog, that's growing too. Airbnb's backlog for the second half of 2023 is about 25% larger than the same time last year. And the app isn't standing still either. Chesky recently received a swathe of new changes, including host passports for those that don't mind sharing rooms with their hosts. In host passports, you get a clearer, more detailed picture of what and where and how you'll be staying, as well as some information on the host and how they score with previous travellers. It's also increased pricing transparency, which was a massive bugbear for some users. Now there's a toggle that you can tick to see the full all-in cost rather than waiting to see all the additional fees they're going to add at the end. They've launched a new partnership with Stripe. They've now got Klarna integration, so you can split the cost of your stay over 4 months interest-free. And Airbnb rooms, booking a room instead of the whole place for cost-conscious travellers, it's now got its own little separate segment, which is going back to the, you know, the original idea of Airbnb, essentially. For hosts, they can now price compare to see what like-for-like apartments in their area and sort of surrounding countries are charging. There's a new checkout to boost bookings, and a new customer service team that they say are answering 90% of calls within 2 minutes. So they mention things like AI and ChatGPT. They know that they're great travel companions, and they see these eventually becoming like travel sort of compendiums, or to help people out, or to basically understand what they did before and try and offer things that are relative or things that they liked before that they will like in their new travel destinations. Details on these, Steve, were pretty thin on the ground, but it does seem like a natural fit to me, so I guess we're going to have to wait and see. But I thought there was a lot to like in there, Steve. I think there's a hell of a lot of good results in there, and I don't really get what the market's problem is. Did you spot anything?
No, I thought this was ridiculous. I don't own this stock, and I'm not about to buy it. I thought it was expensive, and I still do. But that's not any... If I bought it and owned it 17% higher, I wouldn't be looking to get rid of it now on the basis of this. The way I sort of think about this business is, okay, I think of it as a kind of bigger, more expensive holiday version of Rightmove. And therefore, so what do I look for when I look for these kind of things? I look for more people on this platform on both sides, on the supply side, as you put it, and on the kind of booking-based side. And that's getting bigger. I look for this thing to be attempting to make improvements and fend off competition, because network effects... The thing I keep my eye on them with them is they go down as fast as they go up. If you start losing people from one side, then you start losing people from the other side because the incentive goes away as well. But there's no real sign of that happening. I quite like this idea of having a thing to... The kind of small improvements they're making. You mentioned the kind of toggling between full cost and kind of the bit before kind of all in. Who's looking at stuff that's not the all in cost out of interest? And what are they using to compare that for?
I think this was Airbnb problem, really. I think they were putting this up as a kind of like, look how cheap we are, because we've only added half of the costs in. And that's probably, I would say that, if you read around Airbnb complaints, is probably the biggest complaint that people have. So that eliminates that issue by adding the all-in cost together. The other thing that I think Airbnb really does need to crack down on is the cleaning fee. I think that really, really pisses people off that there's a cleaning fee, and usually when you get to an Airbnb, don't know if you've used one, Steve, there tends to be a list of stuff that they kind of make you do when you leave the place, and it might just be as simple as stripping the bed and things like that. But when people go on holiday, they tend not to want to do the washing. That's the reason they're on holiday, and they don't want to strip beds and things like that and put the washing machine on. And I remember reading one that some guy said, if you feel inclined, you could mow the lawn. And I think that's probably not what I'm going to do when I'm on holiday. But I think they're more the, you know, the outlier rather than the norm. But they do get heavily reported as, you know, something that's been a serious issue, when I think it's probably more like a small issue.
We went to an Airbnb last week, actually. I was that's where I was listening to the Berkshire meeting from after the wedding, because I took the baby back and put him to bed, and was then sort of sat waiting for wife to finish because it was her friend's. But ours was great from front to back. I mean, it was okay value for money, I'd say. It wasn't sort of amazing, but it was pretty good when we got there. It was everything we sort of thought it was going to be. It was a kind of sort of cabin. It was like an old farmhouse type thing. We were in a converted stable off the side of it. So that kind of setup of not entirely private, but you know, only attached by doors and walls and stuff to the main building. I thought it was really good. I'd be very happy to keep going there or to anywhere on Airbnb. I'm something of a convert for this, to be honest. I never thought that idea would catch on quite so well, but it really does. And I know one thing they've been variously criticised for, and I think wrongly, is this buyback thing that they keep doing. They have a lot of cash on their balance sheet, as you were saying, and they are in the process of returning that to shareholders, at least some of it. I think you said something like $10 billion in cash and one or two in debt.
Yeah.
So they're sending back about 2.5, and if you knock back the stock-based comp, you can roughly halve that then to sort of maybe just around one and a half. Then it's not quite halving it, but that gets you a return of a sort of just under 2% on a $66 billion market cap. That's not bad, and I'm a fan of them not doing silly things with their cash. I like the idea of improving the app. I like the idea of continuing to find ways to kind of add new features and things that will be genuinely helpful to people. That's what I think is going to help their business grow, rather than trying to do some of the, I guess, more speculative, although investing in real estate or buying property, physical properties, I think that's way off brand for Airbnb. I don't like that suggestion when I heard it at all. But I think they're doing the right stuff here. And I'm on the side that says the buyback is certainly defensible. Yeah, probably the right thing. Maybe the right thing, maybe not. I don't know their opportunity set, you know, well enough to tell you convincingly, oh, absolutely, it's the thing they should be doing. But it's not obvious to me that's a terrible idea at all.
Yeah, and again, we were just harking back to what we said about Berkshire. You think about fine communicators. Chesky is a brilliant communicator. He loves the Airbnb app. He lives and breathes the Airbnb app. So if you pop onto Airbnb's, even on their Twitter feed or just on YouTube, and just grab a copy of the video of the new features, Chesky's there sailing you through them, explaining why he thinks they're great ideas. And he's just really, really, you know, really, really into the Airbnb app and making it the absolute best product for users. And that, for me, is one of the reasons why I think I went for Airbnb. I saw a company that had really struggled during the pandemic, probably should have gone bust, Steve. If money wasn't free, would have gone bust, probably would be a tag onto the Hilton app now or something like that in that case, which makes me shudder as well, Steve. But here we go, a company that lent, you know, how quickly the sort of tides can turn on them and pivoted to profitability. Now we've got a sustainable company generating a hell of a lot of free cash flow, still improving their app, probably got more money than they know what to do with, Steve, and Chesky still absolutely loves it. And I think he's probably going to make a success of this business, Steve, if you don't think it's a success already. I think it grows from here quite considerably.
I was watching some telly a couple of months ago now, I think, and I saw an ad for Vrbo, which is what I think is their biggest competitor, if you don't think for the moment that hotels are the competition. So if you think they're in a different sort of area to hotel, I know there's clearly some overlap, right? But if you think of Vrbo as their biggest competitor, I saw an advert for Vrbo, which made... Sometimes people advertise things and it gives you the exact opposite impression of turning you off their business. Admittedly, they weren't advertising for shareholders. They were advertising for customers nonetheless. But with my shareholder hat on, I'm not shareholder, with my candidate investor hat on, they said the best thing about Vrbo is you always get the whole place to yourself. And I thought, if that's all you've got that is your kind of USP, I don't like your chances here, because I don't care whether other people always get the whole place to themselves. They can do what they like. I care if you have maybe more places than Airbnb for me to choose from. That's the thing. Or more entire places, but you don't, as far as I can tell. They're the same or worse.
I mean, that is like, you know, reword that to get rid of the marketing speak. And that is like, we're Airbnb, but we have less choice.
Yeah. So that was kind of what I heard coming through to me, which was, here's the good thing about us, right? Our name begins with a V. That's why you would want to go with us. Like, well, that might be a thing about your company, but I'm not entirely sure why I would want to, even as a kind of consumer, I'm not sure why I would want to go there. Why can't I just go? I would guess, and I haven't used the Airbnb app because my wife is our Airbnb booker. I would guess that Airbnb quite some time ago let you filter between entire places and don't care whether they're shared or not, right? I mean, There's basic things like Booking.com. I say basic things. Booking.com will let you do that. It'll ask whether you mind staying in like a hostel, dorm, or whether you're going home in an ambulance. No, whether you mind staying in a hostel dorm or whether you want a private room. And you can just click and choose between them. And I can't believe that Airbnb don't have that capacity. They clearly do. And in that case, what do I need Vrbo for?
No, it just seems strange. Seems like somebody's rushed to copy something that they probably shouldn't have done. But it's got a stupid name as well, Steve. I mean, like, what? I mean, I really like the idea of having four-letter names. I think that's great. If you can find a four-letter name, you know, company that, you know... But this is VRBO. Yeah. It's like somebody smashed their head on the keyboard and whatever came up.
I quite like that. I like, but, yeah, I like it where people decided that vowels are sort of optional.
It doesn't even mean anything, though, does it? I mean, like, I want it to mean something. I want it to stand for, like, it could do vacation, rental, beach, outdoors.
Mm. Yep. If anyone knows what VRBO stands for, and I've never seen it with any kind of dots between the letters, which makes me think it does not stand for that, but it does sound like more like a noise than a name. The reason I'm going on about them so much, by the way, not because I'm just filling time here, is because looking at that VRBO ad and thinking about VRBO in general does give me to think just how far ahead of its competition Airbnb is. And that, I think, matters in this kind of thing. Where I think of the obvious network effect moat from Airbnb being the main thing that will keep people on its platform, in that situation, you've got to be ahead. And when it was a race, they were busy racing to get people signed up, and they left other people in the dust. And I think now it's not just a case of wait while VRBO catches up. I think it's now hard for VRBO to catch up, which means that's the strength of Airbnb. Just to come back to the company I meant to be talking about, rather than complaining about lousy advertising I watched.
I think you're right. I think what they're doing now is just piggybacking on Airbnb's success and trying to drain a little bit of the market from people who get disgruntled with some of the things Airbnb do, which when you're the leader in the market, you're going to do some things that piss people off, and the other guys can just piggyback along and try and steal some of that business with very little outlay. And I think it's what they're doing. But Steve, acutely aware we're running out of time. What's next?
Disney's next. Another stock that was down after its earnings this time. So the stock is now... around 168 billion market cap. It's Saturday, by the way, that we're recording this. $168 billion market cap and around $92 a share. I think it's 1 cent short of that. The market was not pleased by this company's earnings. See what you think, Steve. So revenue came in at $21.82 billion, which was up 13%. Earnings per share came in at 93 cents, which was down 14%. That's the adjusted number, by the way, not the GAAP number. I can't remember what it's adjusted for, but I saw other people quoting it, so I thought I would do the same. A little bit of breakdown, and then we'll get into the discussion fairly quickly then. So the direct-to-consumer segment, which is including Disney+, but not just Disney+, it includes things like ESPN and so on. Total subs were down by a couple of percent on Disney+. ARPU was up and higher. Their parks division, which is 36% of revenues and 65% of profits, was growing again. Up another 17% for revenue and 23% for profit. The media entertainment distribution unit, so the Disney Plus E arm, revenue up 3% and profits down 42%. So that's the bit that's sort of 64% of revenues and 35% of profits. Steve, what stuck out to you in this? Let's get after it.
Well, nothing really, and I think that might be the problem with it. I think that it was a pretty average looking report. The things I didn't particularly like about the report as a whole was that when Iger came on board, he said that he thought that Disney had been sort of, he didn't say it in these words, but he thought that Disney had been price gouging on its parks and entertainment. He doesn't appear to have done anything about that, Steve. All of the things that people hate, the lightning passes, etc., they seem to have stayed and they're the same price, so that's not particularly good. Disney Plus, Steve, had a hike in price but then lost a few million subscribers. That's not great at a time when... companies like Netflix are still doing fine. They're still growing. It's a shame to see Disney Plus pulling away like it is. I quite like the idea of them focusing on the quality of Disney Plus and not just trying to get as much quantity out there as possible. But they're pulling back on spending, Steve, so I don't know how you get quality from spending less. I know there's going to be less of it, but, I mean, if I was to cancel something now, it would be Disney+. There's nothing on it. There's nothing I'm interested in. So that's that was particularly disappointing. I was really disappointed to see them sort of leaning back into the sort of linear television, which, again, there is a time and a place for that. That's going to generate some decent revenue for them at the moment, and it's right that they don't move away from that entirely, but that's not a long-term strategy. These all seem like sticking plaster fixes rather than looking at the big issue. And what happened here is basically they've forgotten all of the things Chapek did that were good in terms of Disney Plus. I just come in and it's just like going back to 2018. Like, these are all the things we used to do in 2018. We better all go and do these again. And the problem is that the world's moved on quite a lot since then in the last 5 years. So it was really disappointing. My initial reaction, Steve, when these came through, and I tweeted out, was Chapek was doing a better job than we were giving him credit for. What about you?
Oh, I didn't get to that point, but I think I may be there. I agree with you in the sense of I don't like this sort of shift in attitude towards Disney Plus and, in by extension, the linear networks, basically. So linear networks seem to be in decline, but they are profitable. Disney Plus is the kind of growth opportunity, but it's not at the moment. And what happened this quarter is effectively they shrunk their loss on Disney Plus, so they kind of staunched the bleeding, as it were, with losing money out of that. And worth remembering, I guess, that Disney as a company has been under pressure to do something, from shareholder pressure and activist shareholder pressure, to stop just hammering money out of its streaming division, basically. And they appear to have kind of been moved by that pressure a bit. Or acted in line with that, I guess. They were wanting to say, following the Nelson Peltz thing, yeah, look, we were doing all that anyway. It does happen to be the kind of stuff he was asking for. But yeah, no, this is our idea, not his. I don't know how true that is. I don't really care. What seems to be happening, though, is that, yeah, they've attempted to try and stop the losing of cash out of this thing, and instead they've started losing subscribers out of this thing, which is not good, because if you think the long-term trajectory, like you were saying, is that it's not good for linear networks and it's going to come down to streaming, you have to be ready to battle in streaming and you have to be ready to invest in streaming, or you have to get out of it entirely, is the kind of alternative thought here. But yeah, I view this as a kind of short-term-ish solution. It feels a lot like bean counting to me. That did not encourage me about this report. I had a sort of bigger thought, but yeah, back to you for a moment.
Yeah, bean counting is the word for it, isn't it? These are kind of like bowing to short-term pressure to get short-term results, when long-term, the idea is to build Disney Plus to as absolutely big as it can, then just take your foot off the accelerator when you've got it to a certain size, and those margins will just naturally come through. What we're doing here is somebody saying, oh, well, Disney, before Disney Plus, used to have 25% margins. Now it's got 7 or 8%. That's rubbish. And Iger's gone, oh, well, this thing loses money. I better chop its head off. And that's not really the idea. That's not the reason I bought Disney, put it that way. I like the parks and entertainment business. I even like the linear TV business. I like the sports business, Steve. I think they've got a lot of great strings to their bow. The issue I have is that I was really hoping Disney Plus would come along and be like a Netflix tacked on the side of Disney, and at the moment I'm not seeing that. There were some good things in that report, Steve. It's not all bad. I mean, there was the huge... there's going to be some huge upgrades to some of the Disney parks. They're going to get more features and attractions, and that's always a great thing. There was the Hulu and Disney Plus becoming one app. That is a good thing. I think that's a good idea from them. I'm not sure. I think it's another sticking plaster fix, to be honest with you, but it's a good idea to bring those under each other. I don't see the reason to have two apps. I think that's probably a good reason. But then we have on the other side of it, DeSantis, and Disney still having this big battle, where, you know, the Republicans, who are all about free speech, are denying Disney their right to free speech. So they've made a real mess of this, though, Steve. They've sort of waded into a battle that, well, I say they can't win. They've probably got the best lawyers in the world. They might end up winning it. They've certainly tripped up DeSantis on a couple of things. But the only issue is that rather than them just saying, good, can we just agree to disagree? They're just being boneheaded and fighting each other to the absolute death. And it'd be interesting to see how that goes on. To be honest with you, Steve, I think this has damaged DeSantis to such a degree that I think he's got zero chance of winning any kind of presidential election, which he has coming up. I think he's come across as a proper crybaby. But Disney's not coming out of it looking any better.
I did see that was rolling on, and I saw Bob Iger saying, look, does Florida not want us to do any more business there in that case? Which is an interesting kind of comment, because Florida, by contrast to California, is doing a good job of keeping its taxes down and attracting people as a result. I don't have a strong view there. I pulled a face in the middle of that because you said that's not the reason you bought this stock. I do know the reason you bought this stock, and I forgot to look in the earnings thing. It wasn't front and center, but there is a possibility, I think, maybe it's Bob Iger's ambition to bring back probably around a 0.89% dividend this year. I didn't see any kind of update on that, though. So, I mean, what is the point of owning this stock otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, I just can't wait for my 3 cent dividend or whatever it's going to end up being.
When I can start making mad bank on this kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I do have a lot of shares of Disney, but I didn't buy them. To be honest with you, again, the dividend is just, that's something that just pisses me off because I don't want it. Like, you've got this huge pile of debt, your balance sheet is literally crap. Like, go and sort it out. Stop giving me money, you know, pay off the debt, and then you're going to have all of this spare money because you're not managing a massive pile of debt that, like, frankly, no shareholder wants to see. Manage your debt, then give me the money back or buy back or however you want to do it. The dividend was just obfuscation from me from Iger. It was CEO-manship to cover up a crap report, and unfortunately, he needed it for this one, I think.
Yeah, so I was kind of indifferent to this report. I saw one thing moving in the wrong direction, which was the Disney Plus stuff, and apart from that, I thought it was fine. The company as a whole, though, this is my candidate for being the new Meta, where I think of it as having two parts to its business. One is a proven and profitable and cash-generating business. In Meta's case, that's a family of apps. In this case, it's parks. People know that thing. They'd very much like to own that thing. There's also this attached thing, which is much less certain. In Meta's case, it's the metaverse. In Disney's case, it's Disney Plus and the kind of streaming stuff. The analogy's not perfect. Meta's margins on its family of apps business are much higher than the park's margins, for one thing. But the idea of streaming being profitable is much more proven than the metaverse being profitable. If I was going to put my money on one of these risky things, I'd put it on the streaming thing, not on the metaverse thing. But that's kind of how I feel about... and I think they've both been under similar pressure lately. So Meta switched over to its kind of year of efficiency thing. And on the idea of, oh, we could cut some costs out of this thing, the stock then boomed through the ceiling. Because for a long time, I think investors were looking at it as a way of saying... is your plan just to chuck money into this metaverse hole sort of indefinitely then? Because if you have a really good business that makes really loads of money and your plan is to just light it all on fire, we might as well not have a really good business making really loads of money here. And Zuckerberg has said, at least, no. We're going to try and make some actual money here and we're going to kind of let things pull back some costs on, actually not really the metaverse, but a load of other things instead. In this case, it looks like Disney's kind of gone the other way a little bit. Of it's now trying to pull in this loss-making thing in Disney Plus, and that's made it all worse because there was stuff to be done there. They got to a point with Meta where I said, look, I think this is now priced for basically everything to go wrong. I'm sort of wondering if I feel that way about Disney Plus here, and I get that you can't reason with these companies by saying... well, look, I would buy it just for the family of apps thing or buy it just for the parks thing and you get the other bit for free. Because they're not free. They're busy hammering money out the door on these things. So you need to account for those losses. But I did think on the kind of valuation that we're looking at here, $168 billion. The parks pulled in revenues $16.5 billion in the last two quarters. So if we double that, which you can't because there are seasonal variations, but I think it actually helps the kind of fluctuation from quarter to quarter here. You get about 5x sales. On operating income, you get to about 16x. Yes, there's kind of debt built into that, but if you knock off the interest payments for the whole company, you get to about 18.5x parks earnings. There's a bit of, could you not just stop firing money out the damn door here? And I think this could look like quite good value if it were able to kind of just keep that under control a bit.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. This is your fag packet maths here. But yep. When you you know, when you sell a tape back in, the things are throwing out the door, it will probably look like a decent business. But I fail to see. Well, I don't know. People let us know in the comment section if you are. But are you buying it for the parks and entertainment? Because I think that has growth potential, but I can't imagine it's going to grow exponentially, especially from now when they've really cranked the prices up and seem reluctant to do any more cranking of the prices. Where does Disney's next leg of growth come from? And I always thought that was, you know, this was going to be all the other businesses chugging along at maybe single digits, and then Disney Plus was just going to rocket alongside and become this, you know, excellent sort of tack-on business for Disney. And when they take the focus away from Disney Plus, it worries me somewhat that, you know, I'm going to end up buying a company that might trade at 18.5x earnings, but if it's growing at single digits, do I want to earn it? Do I want to earn it at that kind of? And I think that's tricky for me. I think what my plan, just, and I'm coming up with it right now as we speak, is to just hang on and see who replaces Iger, because I think Iger would tell you he's not going to be here for the long term, although he did say that about 10 years ago. He was planning on leaving Disney and stayed for another 8. But I would be intrigued to see who they bring alongside to replace him. Eventually, he's going to have somebody who he might co-CEO with or something like that. And it'd be interesting to see what they think about the whole situation.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see where their priorities are. So, do you want them to appoint another Chapek? I know you're obviously connected to your sort of tweet, but I don't necessarily mean Chapek in particular. I sort of more mean someone who thinks, right, what we need to do is build this streaming business, and it's going to cost money for some time, but we're going to try and use that money for some time. We're not going to do stuff like buybacks or anything. I'm not saying they're doing buybacks, but not do dividends or anything like that. You're looking for someone to prioritise that that growth engine.
To be honest with you, I think that's a really tricky question, because there's two things I really want out of Disney, which is for them to concentrate on Disney Plus and grow it into a sustainable product. And the other thing I want them to do is reduce the debt on their balance sheet. And those two are kind of like, you know, they're pulling away from each other, aren't they? So I think it's tricky. I think I might have potentially an improbable thesis on Disney that I need to think about.
Oh, I like that. I like an improbable thesis. That's worth thinking about. I think I view this as a buy here. I think I view this as kind of, yeah, a matter of, I don't know, 6 months ago, maybe something like that, where you're looking at this manager and thinking, are you going to ruin this? Because this could be really great, I think. And if you look at one side of your business, I'd buy that and nothing else for this market cap. When I look at the other side of this business, I wouldn't touch it, and I'd really love you to wind it up. I don't think you will, and I don't think you can, but I feel like it looks kind of cheap here, and I get that it's difficult to see anything that's cheap when it has a price earnings ratio of 50, but I think you need to kind of look under the hood a little bit here. And Disney's now at 92. There was a time when we thought that was cheap before now. Yep. Right, and they were losing a lot more money than they are at the moment.
Yeah, true. And we, you know, we could always be being, or I could be being affected just by the general negative press around things when share prices go down. Not immune to that, so that could be part of it.
I feel like this is a good example of that kind of thing, right? Of you need to... the Buffett phrase is be greedy when others are fearful. Howard Marks puts it in terms of optimism, pessimism. I feel like there's a lot of pessimism built into this company at the moment for what's there.
You know what? I think David Gardner is the best for this one, and he always calls it dark clouds you can see through.
That is a nice way of putting it. I think because it puts pressure on you to think about whether or not you can see through them, I think. And that really kind of tests your understanding of what you're thinking of buying and owning and so on.
Steve, are you okay to carry on? I'm going to apologise to the listeners as well. This could be a long episode.
Let's do it.
Okay, right. We've got Nintendo as well. Super Nintendo Charmers. Right, Nintendo reported this week, and it was again, it's been a sort of a habit of this show, quite a mixed set of results, but I think there's quite a lot of promise in this one. I've converted everything back to dollars for you, so it might all be wrong, but this should make life easier for us, because yen, it was in trillions, and I just don't understand that. So look, just as another gentle reminder, when Microsoft tried to buy Activision, they paid two Nintendos for it, and see if you think you've got two Nintendos worth of value in Activision. But here we go. Full year revenue, Steve, came in at $12.59 billion, in line with company forecasts, down about 5% year on year. Net profit was about $3.2 billion, just above expectations. Switch sales were down 22% to $17.97 million, with Nintendo still whinging that access to semiconductors is still causing issues for them. Inventory was up 20%, Steve, so this either means they've overbought and are trying to pull a fast one on us, or they genuinely have lots of part-finished product. I'm willing to give them a pass for what it's worth. They forecasted about $10.7 billion in the next year, with around $3.3 billion of operating profit, so still great margins, revenue to decline. Here's some highlights for you, though, Steve. New Pokemon games sold well, selling over 21 million copies. They look to be about 12% under where the previous generation of games were at this point. Unfortunately, the game didn't score very well. It had a pretty buggy launch date. I wouldn't expect sales to recover, even if this does get fixed. But 21 million is a lot of copies, Steve. That's about double what you get on the other consoles. If any of the other console makers were getting 21 million, they'd be popping corks of champagne. On the other hand, Steve, the new Zelda game has just launched, a massive critical acclaim. tens across the board from all the major review outlets, so much so that the Metacritic, this is an aggregator of reviews to give you a true average, is standing at 97 out of 100. I think that's the highest score I've ever seen. The game is massive. It's well priced. It's at the top of the Amazon sales charts, ahead of things like Vouchers, which have never been unseated. A reminder that the last Zelda score sold about 30 million copies. And since that was released, there's been 95 million more consoles in consumer hands. Steve, this could be a monster. Key to remember, the Mario film isn't in these earnings, so the next quarter's going to look pretty good. It's the first animated film to cross $1 billion in revenue for a while. It's the first film to cross $1 billion in revenue this year. It's currently sitting at $1.2 billion. Still has a hefty streaming deal to negotiate with someone. It should be a great earner, and for the first time has allowed parents of my generation to expose their children to the Nintendo IP that they grew up with. I'd expect bumps in software and Switch sales to follow. Hilariously, Steve, on their investor relations page, they explain this huge success in the following words. Mario Brothers movie was released. An update on Nintendo World, their theme park tie-up with Universal. Grand opening was in February. The management offered very little colour on it. But I did read they're actually spending nothing, Steve, on building these out. Universal are footing the bill entirely, and Nintendo are taking a take rate of about 4%, and they're getting that on park entry and park spending. They are, however, providing Nintendo legend Miyamoto to consult on the look and feel of the park, so this should be authentic Nintendo. So yeah, I think this is a pretty interesting looking company. I think we've got a cyclical Disney on our hands here, if that makes sense to you. Has a much better balance sheet, Steve. It's definitely on the outside of this console cycle, and I think they're expecting things to get worse in terms of their console sales in the near future. But I think this one's got a lot of potential, Steve, and I know you're not supposed to get excited about your investments, but I am quite giddy about this one.
Gosh, that's a nice last business, isn't it? Someone else to do all your park building for you and then just take money as the thing goes along, especially off that top line you were saying on entry and something else. But that's very nice kind of business. This is the kind of franchising business that we like so much, right? Of, you go and figure out all the expensive stuff and just come back and pay us when it's time. I like that very much as a kind of operating model. And it's, what's PE on this, sorry?
Good question.
The reason I ask about this is these franchising things, people tend to know this. It's a pretty open secret, right? That's a very attractive kind of model to be in. It has low costs. It has low overheads. It has nearly no overheads. They tend to be PEs in the 30s. However, this is a Japanese stock, so I don't think it has that.
I still haven't found it.
Okay, so I think this is, in general speaking, then to the kind of business that I like a lot. You said the Pokemon thing, the games had not gone too well, buggy launch, so on. But that's the thing about Pokemon. People will buy the next one. I don't think it will matter. Maybe slightly fewer people will be as quick out of the blocks, but especially with Pokemon, it's the kind of thing that does well by having people on it, and people draws in people. So as long as you get enough of them, I think they're going to be fine. I really like that franchise.
13.96 is your PE.
13.96, so about between a half and a third of what I would be paying for something like Intercontinental Hotels, which has a similar business model. Admittedly, that is all this business model, the hotel company, not just a kind of part of this, and I have no idea how big that will be as part of Nintendo's business. But I really like things that have strong IP. It looks to me like Pokemon has strong IP. I think you talked about this on the InvestorWay podcast, didn't you?
I did.
And my view on the thing hasn't really changed very much. So yeah, Pokemon strong IP, Mario very strong IP. I get the comp to Disney, right? It's the kind of thing that parents know and remember and pass on to their kids, and their kids in some cases engage with them in their own way by in some cases remakes, in some cases kind of adding on and building that out, like Pokemon, and God knows how many of them there are at the moment. I gave up on that a long time ago. I was good with the first 150. I then sort of grudgingly engaged with the next 100 or so, and then after that decided, nah, I ain't got time for this.
Yeah, and they keep releasing them. I think they've only just released this one, and there's two more already slated to come out soon. There's also a Mario Kart DLC, Steve, and then obviously this Zelda game that's just come out, which, I mean, this could sell this could sell a lot of games. I mean, I'm tempted to buy it, Stephen. I haven't turned the Switch on for a short while, to be honest. So it would be quite interesting. But one of the things I like about this business is, look, they're realizing that cyclical business. They're going to do really well. They're going to slow decline, and then the next console they'll do quite well and slow decline, providing they get the console right. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to eliminate some of that cyclicality by having things like Nintendo World. So they're going to take 4% of revenue on that. That could be at least a maybe double digit billion that they could take from that. I think it's 5 or 6 parks planning to open, Steve, so Universal are really trying hard to capitalise on this. But they've also said, look, the movie was such a hit success that they're actually thinking, well, we could do some more of these. We could have our own little, you know, let's call it a Marvel-like franchise of Nintendo movies. They've got plenty of loved characters, Steve, plenty of things that they could expose people to. So the tie-up with Universal is quite interesting on the... on the film side as well. I think it's Comcast who is going to end up seeing the money from this. But I think it's a 50-50 deal, Steve. So whatever they... And remember that, you know, Nintendo just lent the idea and the creative on this. The actual constructing of it was done by Comcast. Illumination, I think it was, the studio. So they could end up with $600 million out of this, Steve, to play with, minus some cost. Then the streaming deal, I assume, would be 50-50 split as well. So could be another $600 million, Steve. They only make $3.3 billion in a year. That's a big chunk added on top that they would never have seen before this. If they can get a movie out every, you know, 6 months or something like that, Steve, we're talking double profit.
That's kind of the thing. I like that bit from the film part of this. So where I think about the risk with these is it becomes tempting, and I'm not saying Nintendo are even looking like getting caught on this temptation yet, but if you think of, to an extent, Disney, to a larger extent, Hasbro, with Wizards of the Coast, and to a larger extent still EA Sports, the temptation is you start going mad with these things and just trying to effectively price gouge your customers by launching new releases like you're a sports team with a new kit every year, or 4 new kits every year. The film industry, I think, lends itself a bit more nicely to that, if people don't mind, because it's not such a big outlay to go and see a new Mario film. It is a big outlay to keep buying a new Mario Kart or something, right? Games are expensive these days, and so are consoles, and none of that stuff is... or some of that stuff can be a significant kind of purchase for someone in a way that going to see a film probably isn't. So I feel like there's more opportunity to keep pushing on this. Hasbro, I heard, were getting into trouble, or a little bit of trouble, by continually launching new expansion packs onto their games, which is... up to them. You're going to test the strength of your IP like that, but they were starting to reach a point where they were attracting attention from their gamers, basically. And EA Sports has a storied history in this.
Yeah, it does. I just thought I'd have a quick look, see their best sellers in PC video games on Amazon, which I would assume is probably where people are going for all of their games and stuff at the moment. Number one is Zelda, like I explained it would be earlier. Then there's a Nintendo eShop gift card voucher. And then we have to scroll down to 6. There's a pad, which is £60, Steve, would you believe? And then number 10 is the OLED model of the Nintendo Switch, the Zelda edition, the special edition that came out. So the fact that it's creeping in number 10, which, just to remind you, is only one place below a PlayStation voucher, I would assume they're quite popular. That's quite interesting to me, Steve. I think there might be an upside surprise on this time next year.
That is interesting to know. Do you have anything else on this one, Steve, or shall we wind it up there? Okay.
That's it.
In that case, thank you very much. This was our show just before we knock off. It's now, of course, Sunday that you're listening to this. Steve, who won Eurovision last night?
Someone that was in it.
Yeah, I don't know any either. Nope.
France,
says Steve. I'll have Bulgaria. Stronger chance yours is in it. Mine may or may not win. Thanks for listening to our show. That was our bold prediction for this week. We will see you next time.